So am I still waiting?
Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Should have added a joke. Just set your alarm clock. It'll wake you up like a punch in the face. Huh. Punch what? In the face is like an alarm clock. Never mind. Terrible joke.
What's same. The punch in the face?
I don't know. I was trying to construct two different ideas there.
Fuck. Well, why did you even say a punch in the face?
Because his
what?
This is terrible.
I didn't really get any of that.
I'm saying like an alarm clock. It feels like a punch in the face when it wakes you up.
It's not a popular saying or anything.
I guess not.
All right. You win some, you lose some.
As darkness envelops the land, the night of reckoning is here.
Judgment Day is upon us.
Four mortal men, warriors all, driven by desperation. Ruled by the cruel hand of fate. Seeking the ultimate glory. The coveted grail that darkens the soul.
The merciless reign over us.
Two jealous suitors. Bound by a common passion. Consumed by envy. Scorned by sins of the flesh. Betrayed by the glimmering light of love.
The sinners lie amongst us.
One vindictive soul. Seeking to avenge an evil deed. A wrath as cold as stone. To be unleashed without remorse. Without mercy. Without regret.
The flame of forgiveness burns no more.
The rulers.
Nursed.
The lovers.
Ridden.
The warriors.
Mercy on their souls.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock with Wei Ting, Zimbabwe Ting.
Ah, yes, yes. Well,
a lot of people enjoyed that.
Yeah, did they?
Yeah, I think they love our little jokes.
Yeah.
Aren't they cute?
That's nice.
How are you doing today, Wei? Both of us just finished the Unforgiven pay-per-view, and for the first time, you and I, the most social of people, watched the last 30 minutes of this pay-per-view together on separate laptops with earphones on
separate streams.
You and I are like the wrestling drones here. They just walk by us and they're like, look at these two.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been even better if they were in sync with one another, the video. I was slightly ahead of you.
Yeah, you were. Well, this is what happens when we leave pro wrestling that we have to watch until the last moment of a three-day weekend. You and I both had more than enough time to watch this show. And yet we left it until the last moment. I can't say I was too excited about what we're watching this week. So I wasn't really jumping.
Oh, wait. This was a random one. And as I was watching this, I was like, why did so many people vote for this show to watch? I mean, this is a fine show, but one that...
not very memorable.
If you were to ask me, you know, name 50 WWF pay-per-views in their history, I don't know if I'd name this one off the top of my head.
Could you name 50?
Like, I think
and name the matches on the show?
Oh, listen, that's probably a separate podcast. I think I could. I think if you were to throw 50 straight main pay-per-views at me, I could not only give you the main event, I could probably give you the city. And if I'm if it's early enough in the morning and my alarm clock punches me in the face, I could probably nail down a date or two in there too.
Wow. Okay.
Throw one at me. Throw one at me right now. Okay, let's see if I can do it.
Survivor Series 1988.
Oh, you're a cunt. Going back to 88.
Yeah. So what? You said
November 26th, 1988.
Is that right? Let me bring that up. Well, can you name the main event?
It's
actually November 24th.
Oh Jesus, that was my backup guess. You went way too far into the past.
I didn't know there were rules here.
24 years here.
I thought you had a real talent.
All right, let me redeem my credibility. Something post 95.
All right.
Okay, I think that's fair.
Survivor Series 1997.
Oh, that's an easy one. Come on. November the 9th.
Oh, yeah.
Oops. That's a pretty well-known pay-per-view. Probably the most well-known show. What was the main event, though, on that show?
I don't know. Let me look that up.
It was Shane and Mick Foley.
All right. No Way Out 2006.
No Way Out 2006. Headlined by... a double main event. We had Randy Orton and Rey Mysterio in the Eddie Guerrero tribute match. And then we also had on that show, it would have been title match with Kurt Angle and The Undertaker.
I haven't even looked this
We've up. Reviewed this show.
Sorry, what did you say?
I said Kurt Angle, Undertaker,
and
Randy Orton, Rey Mysterio.
You have a... Oh, that's good. Okay, let's try another one. Is this just WWF or WCW as well?
You know what? Throw me curveballs. Wait,
Slamboree.
Jesus.
1996.
96. That was the Lethal Lottery Tag Tournament.
What the hell?
Yeah. We had all makeshift tag teams for the evening. And it also featured Big Show, Paul White, The Giant, versus... Lex Luger for the WCW title.
Did you say 1996? I said 1996.
Yes, you said 96.
You're completely wrong.
What?
Slamboree 1996, May 1996. The main event, the American Males, Marcus Bagwell and Scotty Riggs defeated the Shark and Max.
That is not the main event.
That's what it said. It said the main event.
Yeah, because the pre-show was called main event.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, don't fuck around.
Yeah, the Giant defeated Sting.
Oh, Sting. It wasn't Sting. It was not Luger, I mean. It was Sting.
With Lex Luger.
With the Lethal Lottery Tournament. Am I not right on that?
It was the Battle Bowl match, actually.
Is that what they called it?
Yeah. Who did you say was in it?
Oh, it was like 16 or a bunch of different tag teams.
And who won?
Oh, Jesus. Who won? That's tough. I'm going to say...
Listen, they call this a Battle Bowl match.
DDP won.
Yeah, you're right. Well, still very impressive.
Yeah, not as great as advertised, though.
Yeah, but, you know.
Why don't I try one with you?
Okay,
Backlash,
okay.
1999.
Backlash, 1999.
I'll be impressed if you get the month right.
Well, April.
Okay, very good. You don't want to throw a date out there? You want to throw a dart against the...
April 19th, 1999.
Not bad, because that was a Sunday. But April 26th, I believe, was the actual date.
Let me double check this.
You go look that up. You look up April 19th.
What did you say?
Wait a minute. No, you're wrong. 19th was a Monday.
And what did you say?
I had said previously it was a Sunday.
What date did you say?
Backlash?
Yeah.
The actual date was April 25th.
Yes, you're right.
People are getting like scared.
I'm not even going to guess a main event.
John Pollock, graduate of the Knowledge College.
Well, John, you certainly are.
How did
very
we get
talented.
Off into this tangent here? Unforgiven.
Ego. That's how.
Unforgiven. I guess you just looked it up, so we can't continue this game of you guessing the main event. Or did you look at the main event?
I saw the poster.
That doesn't reveal the main event.
All right.
What do you think the main event was?
Main event of April 1999 in the WWF. Well, it's not too far removed from this pay-per-view.
Actually, this was a wildly popular time, so of course you were not anywhere been, to be found watching.
Nope, this would have been right after WrestleMania 15.
Ooh,
so I could guess.
Good.
I could guess.
That's cheating because it corresponds with your age.
No.
WrestleMania does.
My guess for the main event: Triple H versus The Rock.
A valiant effort. It was The Rock and Steve Austin.
Really?
In a rematch from WrestleMania 15.
That's so stupid. All right. You win.
Backlash 2000, Triple H versus The Rock.
That's what I was thinking of.
And you know what Backlash 2000 featured? The return of Steve Austin after the car accident, and then he would disappear for months and then make his reemergence at Unforgiven 2000 from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
See what we did there, everybody?
It's like 6 degrees of wrestling idiots.
Yep, that was our intent.
September 24th of 2000, Way. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Philadelphia, the home of WrestleMania 15.
Okay. Wow.
Tons of times.
I'm scared now. I'm kind of scared.
This is amazing, Way. This is my life. This is how my brain functions.
I'm trying to picture you with any other type of career. What if this job was not available? What if you didn't live in this city?
I'd be a homeless person that would just be screaming out dates at people, and they were like, "That guy's crazy."
That guy's crazy. You definitely found.
You go test this out, Way. You go, go up to some random girls and say, "Hey, do you know what was happening on September 24th of 2000?" See how they respond.
Probably call the cops.
Maybe. Maybe.
It was just this creep shouting wrestling references at me.
Just yell, "Unforgiven, Unforgiven." So the show opens up with this interesting video. It was like this fairy tale almost, with the evil woman that they would use every now and then and Freddie Blassie to compare. I always loved the Freddie Blassie voiceover videos.
He's a great voiceover guy.
Yes, and this woman was just like from the Enchanted Forest of Stamford, Connecticut or something, with lots of candles and religious overtones. The great setting for a pay-per-view called Unforgiven.
Yeah, I'd say so.
So,
Who would have been on the creative staff at this time?
Brian Gewirtz.
In 2000.
He started like summer, I want to say, of 2000. That's how long this guy has been with the company to emphasize how crazy this is.
And who was in the lead?
At this point, it was a guy named Chris Kresge who eventually he left shortly after this. And he's been regarded as one of the best writers they ever had. He had everything mapped out kind of long term of where they were going. And he's... For those that worked with him, they've talked about just how great the show was run when this guy was kind of running things, and this was during his time period.
And where did he go?
Afterwards, he actually wrote the biography of David Wells, the baseball pitcher, a book I own, actually, not even realizing the connection of the writer. And he actually, sadly, passed away a few years ago. I think it was from cancer.
Oh, wow.
And, died very young. So he was, at this point, kind of your main guy writing the show and stuff, but Gewirtz was there. I'm sure Michael Hayes was involved at this point in some form or fashion, and ultimately, of course, Vince and Pat Patterson were involved, so I think that's a good idea of the creative team. This is like a year removed from Russo and Ferrara leaving, this was kind of their... that was kind of the beginning of the creative team after Russo and Ferrara left, and that is what we got. One of the biggest years in wrestling history.
Yeah, this pay-per-view in particular, coming off of SummerSlam 2000.
Yes. This was presented by RC Edge Cola. Is RC Edge Cola still around?
I have not seen a can of RC Cola.
This was the shitty cola your school would buy you because they didn't want to spring for the brand name of Coca-Cola.
Oh, we always had President's Choice.
That's the Canadian equivalent, I think, of RC Edge Cola.
Yeah, yeah.
Announcers for tonight, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, promoting the fact that this event sold out in 2 hours, featuring the return of Steve Austin, who, as we mentioned, he had made the brief appearance at Backlash earlier that year. But this was the real return. This was him. He was coming back, and he was going to find out who ran him over with a car the year prior in 2000. Quite the angle at the time. It was like their big cliffhanger storyline of who ran this man over and what a payoff we would get.
It was their Claire Lynch. It was their Aces and Eights.
Yes, it was. It was their Claire Lynch, I guess, with better performers.
Yeah.
Well, Rikishi, I guess, debatable.
Yeah, well.
Though that reveal is here 12 years later. That's what that line is to me, the first thing I think of with Rikishi.
I did it for The Rock.
I did it for the people.
It ruined his career.
Well, he's another guy I look at. Was really, how far were you going to go with this guy?
I'd say you were going to go pretty far.
As a main event guy, I just never bought him.
And it's just, well, why not? What about Yokozuna? Did it say a similar stature, similar style?
Rikishi's gimmick was that he wore a thong.
So what? So is Yokozuna's? Well, he didn't wear a thong. But he had a big ass.
Big, but this was a dancing man in a thong.
Right? Yeah, but at the same time, he was very convincing in the ring. He was the guy who danced, but could actually beat people up.
His signature spot way was putting his bare ass into men's faces.
It was a signature spot, but that was just to embarrass. He actually had devastating maneuvers. The bonsai drop.
The Rikishi driver.
Which was banned.
Well, I think at some point we should review that reveal. The reveal raw with Rikishi.
Right, okay.
One day.
We could do that.
Kevin Kelly is in the back awaiting the arrival of Steve Austin. And Kevin Kelly essentially just stood here and stood there and stood there. And they kept checking back with him, awaiting Steve Austin.
That's what a reporter does.
He was very committed to the job. Yeah. And we start things off with the Dudley Boys and the Acolytes taking on Right to Censor, Steven Richards, The Good Father, Val Venus, and Bull Buchanan.
How far in advance had the Right to Censor debuted before this?
They had started, I believe, in the summer, or maybe just before the summer.
This was a couple months.
Yes. So they were, at this point, this was a direct response, obviously, to the PTC, the Parents Television Council, with L. Brent Bozell III. And this was a huge public relations battle that the WWF was having, mainly with the PTC, who was going after all the sponsors of the WWF, trying to get them to boycott the WWF. And then later it was revealed that the PTC and Bozell, they exaggerated a lot of facts involving the WWF. And it was actually, this went to court with Bozell not coming out the victor in this. So this was how the WWF dealt with stuff. Make some heels out of it. And RTC, they came out to a car alarm. That was their theme music.
Yeah. Sirens.
Yeah, just a piercing theme song that just drove you insane hearing them come out.
I think the idea was a good idea. I even think the car alarm.
It's good heat, especially cool. Taking characters that fans had liked for so long, like The Godfather and Val Venus.
Well,
and turning them.
But that's where I felt like this was a mistake, because those characters had a lot of color, a lot of personality. You put them in a group like this, as much sense as it made, it just completely robbed them of any personality they had. They all dressed the same. None of them had any more personalities. They were the Putty Patrol all of a sudden.
That is true. I liked the fact that they felt the Godfather, they have to change his name to the Good Father, but Val Venus remained intact. Val Venus.
What could they have changed his name to?
Val Morley. I don't know.
What the, penis is like a technical term. It's not
Val
a dirty.
Condom. Val Protection. Val Crow. I don't know. I have nothing. You might have to lose Val.
Oh, man.
I don't know. To me, it was always a gimmick with a certain shelf life to it. And believe me, by 2000, I think a lot of people were tired of the gimmick.
Sure.
The porn star was very novel in 1998, but it wore thin. And unfortunately, this was a guy who I always thought was very talented, but never was able to overcome a limiting gimmick.
Yeah.
Whereas right. A guy like The Godfather, I think... he was very content in that opening to second match kind of performer. Crowd enjoyed it, and that was his stake. This guy was never going anywhere further. But I always thought with Val Venus, one day he could have gotten somewhere higher, but never did.
Mm.
Anyway, and then there was Bull Buchanan. Buchanan. Crowd was into the match right away, chanting for tables. I thought the crowd was very hot here in the opening match. They loved the Dudleys, especially here.
Mm-hmm.
The Good Father misses Bubba in the corner and gets suplexed. Bradshaw comes in and hits a neck breaker to Bull Buchanan that nearly achieved its namesake. This looked so clumsy that I thought Bull Buchanan was going to die from this. Jim Ross snuck in a Mr. Wrestling 2 reference here to Val Venis being all in white, which actually this past week on Rawway we got a Mr. Wrestling 2 reference from Jim Ross after the knee lift spot. Where there were comparisons to Harley Race and Triple H, and then Jim Ross said, Mr. Wrestling 2 as well. So there he goes. They got the heat on D-Von, who eventually made the hot tag to Bubba. Bubba hit a Bubba bomb to Venis, runs through the rest, and finally they get to Steven Richards. And all this was building up to Steven Richards taking some kind of bump, but Val Venis cut them off. Everyone was in the ring fighting to the floor. They went for the Doomsday device, the Dudleys did, but Val Venis gets saved by the Good Father. Richards then runs in and hits the Steven kick to Bubba, and Val pins him at 6 minutes and 4 seconds. So the heels win, but after the match, they hit the what's up spot to Richards. They call for the tables. The audience is going insane here. They go for a powerbomb through the table, but RTC makes the save. Babyfaces make their comeback, fight off all of the heels, hit a double spinebuster to Richards, and then finally powerbomb him off the second rope through the table, and the crowd gets what they want, Steven Richards getting powerbombed through a table.
This is a brief but pretty hot opener to start off the show, and as you mentioned, the Dudleys were just incredibly over. All their spots, the what's up.
The what's up spot, when it was this commercial had just come out a few months earlier.
Did it?
Yeah. It was
like 1999?
I always thought it was... Well, it was around this period. It was at least...
Was,
believe me, it was much more relevant in 2000 than when they were still doing this years later.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine watching this match that Bubba Ray Dudley and Bradshaw would turn out to be two of the best heels in recent memory.
Yeah, really. Hunter is with Stephanie in the back. And Stephanie is worried about the ribs of Hunter, says that everything with Angle ends tonight, and she understands this, and will never defend Kurt Angle again, and thought that Kurt was her friend. And Hunter says, does a friend force himself onto you?
What was your thoughts on this love triangle?
I thought Angle. The storyline was awesome, and it didn't achieve what it needed to in its blow-off, I thought. But this angle, I thought, was great.
Was this the blow-off?
Yeah, this was it.
This was it, huh?
This was it.
All right.
Never really went back to it after this pay-per-view, but I thought the build-up was great. They built it up all summer long for this, and with Kurt, he was still doing the goof character at this point, and I thought he was really evolving out of that, hopefully with this angle. Pardon the pun. But anyway, they show Kevin Kelly. He's still waiting. And then we got a match with Jerry Lawler against Taz in a leather strap match in Philadelphia.
What's the significance of that?
Well, Taz, I think the crowd was going to be behind the heel here in this match.
Okay.
And the booking of this was very interesting. Lawler gets yanked by Taz at the start and gets suplexed and chokes him right in front of Jim Ross and is mocking Jim Ross as Ross gets upset, tells Taz to shut up, and calls him an idiot. And Lawler whips him on the floor, gets cut off by a low blow. Then Lawler hits his pile driver to Taz, and the heel no-sells it. Lawler hits another pile driver. Taz stands right back up. Then Lawler hits a third one, and he gets right back up. Odd booking of the heel.
No. And then he.
Oh, and then he takes
delayed.
The face plant. Yes,
it was a delayed sell. It was like the Japanese thing.
I guess so.
Well, I thought it was fine. You would never ever see this happen today, though.
No,
you saw a pile driver. No one's good enough.
I can't imagine Lawler was down with this. For his pile driver. This is his spot.
Okay, but in 2000, the pile driver was just... It might as well have been a transitional move. It's not like they didn't protect it like they have over the past 10 years. It meant very little. It was like a suplex.
Lawler goes to hit the turnbuckles. He hits three of them but cannot get the fourth when he tries to grab Taz on his back. And Taz kicks the referee. And Raven shows up to a big pop, DDTs Lawler, they chant ECW, and Taz applies the Taz mission and gets a submission win at 5:06, won't release the hold, and they help Lawler to the back with the officials. So Taz was the heel here, though everything about this match to me, it was booked in Taz's favor. The guy in Philadelphia comes up from the pile driver, you have Raven run in here to attack the babyface. It was weird booking, I thought.
Well, I don't necessarily follow. Taz cheated. He cheated to win.
I felt the crowd loved this.
Yeah, they loved it. But this is hostile territory. With that said, I didn't think that this crowd was that behind Taz. I was surprised. They were much more behind the Dudleys than they were Taz.
Well, this was Raven's return to the WWF after a year in ECW. And, yes, would be his, the beginning of his final run in the WWF.
Yeah, oh, wow.
As Raven. The last time this audience had seen him, he was Johnny Polo.
That's right.
So if you had not watched ECW or WCW, you would have been really confused. Who is this guy?
Right.
But yeah. No one was. Everyone knew who this guy was.
People knew who he was, and he was set to embark on a... What a career
big hardcore
path.
Title run.
Oh, huge. Multiple.
He would win like 40 titles.
A great Sunday night heat slots waiting for him.
Yep. And then transition over to NWA TNA.
Yeah.
Steve Blackman is in the back warming up with a bunch of weapons, and Kevin Kelly gets excited when a car arrives and it's Austin. Says he isn't here to answer questions and just beats the shit out of Kevin Kelly and throws him into the garage door. Poor Kevin Kelly.
This was hilarious. Throughout this entire show, they just had Steve Austin showing up and kicking people's asses.
Steve Austin.
Imagine a babyface doing this. Imagine John Cena doing this today and getting cheered like this.
Oh, people would love it.
People would love it, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a perfect thing you just want from a guy. Just a guy who just shows up and just destroys everything in his path.
So, Lawler could not continue with his commentary duties, so we went to Jim Ross and Michael Cole in 2000.
Pretty bizarre.
Pretty crazy. The only difference between 2000 and 2012 was the frosted tips of Michael Cole's hair.
Right. And a few pounds. Cole was very thin.
He was much thin.
Before he started working out, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. So Michael Cole joins Jim Ross here, and they replay the Austin attack literally 30 seconds after we watched it live. Just in case you missed something.
Yeah.
So great recap. Al Snow comes out. He is the European champion at this point and was doing a gimmick where every week he would come out representing another country in Europe, and this time he was Italy.
Complete with a...
A dead fish.
Yeah.
And we had a Tony Danza picture.
And theme music.
Yes.
Like Italian music. And he would shout what he would do, like, what does everybody want in Italian. Like in the language
of
that.
Oh, is that
country.
What they did?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
They just put it in Italian. Well, that's clever.
They put a lot of effort.
I enjoyed the Al Snow Tour of Europe run he had here. I mean, this was the most value you could have got out of someone as the European champion during this time period. So, hey, at least they did something with it to differentiate him. So we have a hardcore invitational title match here with Steve Blackman defending the title. This is the same concept they did at WrestleMania earlier this year where there is a 10-minute time limit, unlike the 15-minute one at WrestleMania. I think they realized it dragged the last time.
Oh, really? As if this one didn't?
Well, we had Steve Blackman, Al Snow, Crash Holly, Test, Perry Saturn, and Funaki. Funaki.
Yeah.
All former champions were...
Are they all former hardcore champions?
That's what they said here.
Okay.
Right at the start, Perry Saturn hits a suicide dive into a trash can lid by Steve Blackman, and then they did a comedy spot where Terry throws in head, and they say that Saturn got head from Terry and then gave head to Trish. Huh. These jokes were not old by 2000 at all.
Mm-mm.
No. People, this made no sense. People were not going after Steve Blackman, who was the only person you could pin here to become champion. There was no value in going after anybody here.
Mm. You want to defeat everybody. You want to weaken those other people so that they don't have a chance to go against Steve. Yeah, I don't know.
Crash fucked up a top rope Hurricane Rana and nearly killed somebody. Everyone is on the floor. Camera almost misses a top rope moonsault to the floor by Saturn. Ross says that Test is the only one with brains because he's going after Steve Blackman, in case anyone else hadn't pieced this together.
Mm-hmm.
Crash finally pins Steve Blackman at 3:53, runs up the aisle, but then Saturn pins him after a lid shot to the head. Then Snow takes a lid shot, and then there's headshots to Snow by Blackman and Funaki. They fight into the crowd. Saturn goes for a kendo stick under the ring. And did you notice when he pulled up the ring skirt, they had a Raw is War banner there?
Oh.
That was weird. Why would that be set up?
Maybe they're just setting up for the next day.
I'd have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
Blackman attacks Saturn with a bunch of sticks, attacks the rest with the kendo stick, lays out Saturn and pins him with a minute left, and then everyone attacks Blackman in the aisle as time runs out. What a climactic finish here. Everyone just huddling on everybody in the aisle as time expires and Steve Blackman keeps his title.
I just hate these matches. I hate these matches. Just people, like, taking these stupid bumps for no reason. Nothing's memorable. Nothing's done to any dramatic effect. It's just hit me with this trash can lid. Hit me with this cookie sheet. And the lineage and the concept of a title entirely is just completely pissed on. And 10 minutes is way too long. Way too long.
Should have been 1 minute. That would have been fun.
Oh,
one-minute scramble.
Yeah.
Anyway, 10 years later, do you miss the hardcore title? That's how long it's been gone. Along with the European title.
No, I can't say
I don't miss either titles. Kurt Angle is showing off his medals to Tony Garea and another guy. And in walks Steve Austin, who won't shake Kurt's hand. And Kurt says that the Olympics celebrate hard work and determination, just like your comeback, Steve. And he puts one of his medals around his neck, says it's smaller than his actual Olympic one. And Austin attacks Kurt, beats the hell out of him in the hallway.
I thought Austin was hilarious, just deadpanning everything Kurt does.
This was probably the first interaction between Austin and Angle on television.
Is that right?
The next match was built up after a dreaded nunchuck attack by X-Pac to Chris Jericho.
Multiple nunchuck attacks. This was his weapon of choice.
You know what I learned here, Wei?
What?
It's nunchuck.
Yeah.
For years, I thought it was numchuck. And I looked it up here during this match. Nunchuck.
I'm happy for you.
Does anyone really use does anyone really use nunchucks?
Not that I know of.
Like, I don't see them being something that you would carry on you in case you had a street fight.
I think they're illegal, actually.
I think they're illegal as well.
Yeah.
Much like switchblades in Canada.
Are those illegal?
I've heard switchblades are illegal in Canada.
Like a pocket knife?
You're not allowed to have knives that have some, like, quick release to them.
I carry a regular knife?
A knife? I don't know. I wouldn't encourage anyone to carry knives on them, but I think...
If I had a sheath on my knife, like a mini sword.
Why don't you try this out and report back next week?
Hey, everybody. I have a knife in my
pocket. I'm in prison for carrying an illegal weapon.
But these nunchucks, you're right. It's hard to take anybody seriously.
Like, when they're using goofy.
When they're using nunchucks. If your name isn't Bruce Lee, you're not looking cool with nunchucks. What are you, a fucking ninja turtle? You're hitting people with nunchucks?
Oh, man. Who was the one with nunchucks? Was it Michelangelo?
Yeah.
He was always my favorite. I liked him.
He's a party dude.
Yeah.
Is that the line?
The lamest was Donatello with a stick. That was
pretty lame.
You have to base it on video games and what was the best weapon to have. You had Raphael with, like, the lances.
The size.
And then, of course, Leonardo had the sword.
That, cool, to
me, was too easy. That was the go-to with Leonardo. So I always favored Michelangelo.
Nobody wanted to be Donatello. Like, we played Ninja Turtles in this playground. Nobody would want to be Donatello. The smart guy who wants to be smart. With the stick.
When we used to play Ninja Turtles at recess, it would always be four of us, and the last pick was always, you get to be Donatello.
Yeah.
And then my friend would always joke and say, "Hey, Donatello, the baseball diamond's over here. This is for fighting." It's like, oh, shit. You got owned, you and your stupid fucking stick.
Wow.
X-Pac against Chris Jericho. This was a rematch from Unforgiven 1999.
Oh.
Interesting.
And what was that feud over?
That was a cage match. This was a straight match.
This was a nunchuck match.
Jericho actually talks about this in his second book when the fall of 99, Vince just cut this promo on Jericho in the back saying, "You're not even worth the paper your contract is written on." Vince hated him at this point and said, "You are going to work with X-Pac and you do everything he says." So this was a year later, so I think they had warmed to Jericho's style at this point. But it was a rough beginning for Jericho that he outlines in his book.
X-Pac was in the middle of a heel turn over the past few weeks, having attacked the Road Dogg and even Triple H, shoving Triple H down steps.
Really?
Yeah.
Was this in the video?
No, that's what he said. That's what Jim Ross said.
Yeah. Well,
shoved him down some steps.
I guess Hunter was like a bit of a babyface at this point. He was turning, I guess, for the sake of the Hunter program.
The Angle.
Yeah, the Angle program. Jericho runs to the ring as X-Pac bails out. X-Pac goes for a Bronco Buster but gets cut off by a clothesline, and then Jericho goes for a springboard dropkick but is sent to the barricade on the floor, and then hits a somersault plancha to the floor on Jericho, and they fight by the announce table. Jericho goes for his face plant, but X-Pac counters with a sleeper hold, and Ross notes that there's no money in being a sidekick, in reference to X-Pac and, I guess, separating himself. And then Michael Cole, with the segue of the year, Jericho hits a spinning heel kick as Cole says, "Speaking of sidekicks."
Yeah.
Did you catch that as I
did? I did. That was good.
I laughed out loud. Good for you, Michael Cole.
That's where that more reporting Syracuse background comes in.
Yeah. I also took it to be funny, as Ross said, there's no money in being sidekicks, as he was probably giving the death stare to Michael Cole.
Ah,
his sidekick for the night.
Wow.
For not even the whole night. Maybe that was Ross's cue to get Lawler back out.
Right. And Michael Cole would remember this for the next 12 years. Now who's the sidekick?
X-Pac finally hits his Bronco Buster, but then Jericho stands up and just powerbombs him. Quite the counter to the Bronco Buster. And Jericho hits a Bronco Buster. Someone needs to make a GIF file out of this and put it online of Jericho delivering the Bronco Buster.
You know,
this looked ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. Listen, it's the Bronco Buster. How much technique is there in rubbing your crotch in a man's face?
Face full of stuff.
There's quite a bit. Not everybody can pull off the Bronco Buster, and you know, a lot of people have tried. A lot of women have tried. They've looked terrible.
Tigress on Nitro.
Sure. But I would say, you know what? If I had to pick my favorite Bronco Buster, I think X-Pac delivers a pretty good Bronco Buster. He gets some good rhythm in there.
Ray was up there. Ray kind of, he always looked a little silly, like he was riding like one of those mechanical horses at the supermarket.
Yeah,
because the guy was always so big, and he was just had a smile on his face.
He didn't have much finesse.
Yeah, it's almost like he had to insert a quarter before he did the Bronco Buster. X-Pac got his nunchucks and misses with them, and Jericho gets a roll up. X-Pac then hits the X-Factor, only gets a two count. Jericho comes back with a power bomb, gets the walls, X-Pac to the ropes, he pulls him out. But it gets broken, takes a spinning heel kick for a two count, lion salt with the knees up, and then X-Pac comes off the second rope. Jericho catches the legs, applies the walls for the win, and he won't release, but gets the win. 9 minutes and 3 seconds, but the feud must continue, Way, as Jericho gets attacked by the nunchucks after the match.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they should do something about that. You know what? I thought this was a very good match. From start to finish, it worked an incredibly fast pace, and I've always thought Sean Waltman was a very underrated worker, especially at this point.
I always thought I always enjoyed his
when
stuff.
People started to get sick of this character.
Yes.
His character is terrible, okay? But he's always been consistent in the ring. He's always been strong in the ring, and this was a great example of that. This was, I thought, a very good match.
And even today, with all the injuries he's been through, all his neck problems, I mean, last year he kind of just pulled out. I mean, everyone was raving about him at the King of Trios tournament a year ago.
It was the 1-2-3.
Yeah, and he did it again this year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's someone that, I mean, he's obviously extremely limited today, and this was 12 years ago. I mean, he was a very good worker, but you're right. The character was a big, big turnoff.
And it's not just the gimmick that they would give him. It's just the way he looks and the mannerisms this guy does. Like, did you ever notice? Every time he does a big move, he raises his arms. Like O'Doyle, like in Billy Madison, like O'Doyle rules. He just raises his arms after every match, and I know it's kind of for heel heat, but it's just, for a guy of his stature, it just looks so stupid. Looks goofy.
Mick Foley is in the back. This was when he was still the commissioner, and he was doing reps of practicing slapping the mat because he would be the guest referee for Angle and Hunter. Angle walks in complaining about Austin attacking him, but said, "I am going to compete tonight because I won the Olympic gold medal with a head cold. Not to mention, I also had IBS, irritable bowel syndrome." Ugh. Just total geek here.
This was not funny.
It wasn't funny.
Foley was trying to stack a joke on top of Angle's joke. And Foley's like, "Yeah, you do BS a lot."
I wasn't, Kurt Angle was a very funny performer, but there came a time where this got to be too much, and this was that time period. And I know a lot of people will be like, "Hey, it was funny. You don't have a sense of humor." But you know what? It was this stuff that I really think did somewhat limit Angle in terms of how people perceived him. The Rock is in his locker room, and Steve Austin walks in, and they have a big stare down. And this would be our tease, our first tease of WrestleMania for the next year. It should be the Houston show.
Oh, right. Yes, yes.
And they tease Dissension, but then they shake hands, and they say they're all cool. And Austin says, but it was your rent-a-car at Survivor Series. And Rock says, well, anyone could have taken my keys. And then who walks in but Joe Hitchin, Joey Legend, who was going by Just Joe.
Joe who?
Just Joe.
Just Joe.
This was maybe his biggest career moment in the WWF. I mean, people saw him in TNA, and he'd done a lot of stuff in Europe, but to a mass audience at the peak of the WWF, this was probably... This will probably be on his Wikipedia page. Did was he? Once in a pre-tape with Steve Austin and The Rock.
Did he not have a match?
No, he had matches, but name me a Just Joe match you okay. recall. This guy, I remember, this was, I interviewed Just Joe in early 2000, like just a few months before he was going to debut. And I had watched this guy on the indie scene here in Ontario.
Wait, did you interview him for The Law?
No, this was before I worked for The Law.
This was for Jaws?
This would have been for the Jaws.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I got Just Joe right after he signed his contract.
John's Audio Wrestling? What was it?
Yeah, that was it.
John's Audio Wrestling.
Audio Wrestling Show.
Do you have that? Do you have that interview?
I might.
Oh, please.
I remember that interview for two things. Number one being that someone else rudely interrupted as I was conducting this interview. Right in the middle of doing this interview, came up to talk to Joe as I'm doing this interview. So that put me off. And the second was being that I ended it by saying, well, Joe, it's been a pleasure. We wish you all the best in the WWF. And we hope to talk to you years down the road after you've headlined WrestleMania.
Huh.
I thought this guy was going to be like...
You jinxed him.
I thought this guy would be like... The next coming of Edge, you know, a Toronto guy that makes it. And then I got my first idea of where this guy would be when he made his debut unannounced on Sunday Night Heat.
Mm.
And then got this horrendous gimmick and, needless to say, Just Joe.
How did this not get over? What is this gimmick?
Well, I think the whole idea behind this guy's gimmick was to be a shot at the dirt sheet. He was this guy that overheard stuff in the locker room and would be a snitch. And that's how they would perceive the internet at the time. This guy was just like your internet stooge. That's what I took it to
be. An internet stooge who also wanted to become a champion? Where does that figure?
I don't think championship aspirations were part of the Just Joe character. Nonetheless, he walked in and he talked about what he's overheard in the locker room, and Austin just beats the shit out of him.
Mm. Yeah, that was it.
That was just that.
Yeah, you know what? He could say that he was beaten up by Steve Austin. Not many people can.
Him and Kevin Kelly on this night can both boast for that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a steel cage match up next. Edge and Christian defending the tag titles against the Hardys. And, man, at this point, I looked this up. Matt, Edge, and Christian were all 26 years old during this time, and Jeff was 23.
Wow.
And I look at the roster right now, and it's like, who right now is, 23 to 26 in that age range. That I mean, when you were watching these four, I think a lot of people saw these four. They were all on the rise, mm-hmm. and you had that, man, in 5 years, where will these four be? You've got to get at least one, if not two, main event stars out of this foursome. And, I mean, you really did in Edge and Jeff,
mm-hmm.
did ascend to that level. But, man, you look at, like, everyone right now, it seems like they look at Dolph, who, man, Dolph is turning 32. Sheamus is turning, I think, 35. I mean, who are our young talents?
Yeah.
I mean, John Moxley, maybe?
Well, what do you think? Why do you think that is? Do you think they're spending too much time putting these guys on the developmental?
I don't know if it's a hesitancy to push guys at such a young age, but at the same time, when you wait so long, like Antonio Cesaro feels like a new guy, and he's 31,
mm-hmm.
32.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are not young at this point, and I just question that when you finally pull the trigger on some of these guys, like a Sheamus, how many quality years are you going to get out of them? When Sheamus is turning 35, and to me, that's kind of the peak point at this point. I mean, Jeff Hardy is not even 35 right now.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy, mm-hmm. and he's younger than Sheamus. Anyway. Yeah. It's just something that, you know, at this time they were focusing on younger talent. These four were kind of in that kind of mix. Anyway, they showed a clip from SmackDown building this up where Edge and Christian, dressed as Sherlock Holmes and Watson, found some young clips of the Hardys cutting promos.
Yeah.
Mad as high voltage.
This was very funny. They were doing a Mystery Science Theater with this footage. They were showing a lot more personality at this point. At what point would you say Edge and Christian really started?
As kids or as the Hardys?
No. Edge and Christian.
Oh, Edge and Christian.
At what point would you say that they started to develop their characters and weren't just kind of, you know, the brood?
It was like in the spring of that year. It was like they were still like the baby faces up and through WrestleMania, and it was shortly after WrestleMania they became the like comedic heels. Mm-hmm. Who both of them, their main guy they said they worked with was Brian Gewirtz, who. Mm. I mean, the guy he's a very polarizing figure, but there are people that swore by the guy. Edge and Christian, The Rock, they all really credit Brian Gewirtz as helping them tremendously with promos and skits backstage. Hmm. So, depends who you talk to. Anyway, the match begins, and the Hardys get the advantage. They hit a poetry in motion to Christian into the cage. And Jeff goes to the top, teases a swanton, but gets crotched, and then knocked down to the floor. So he cannot re-enter the match. So it's 2-on-1 for Edge and Christian.
Okay, that was the assumption. That was the assumption made by Michael Cole.
Yes.
Which Jim Ross later said was incorrect.
So he could come back into the cage.
And then Michael Cole says, oh, JR, I was only saying he's physically outside of the cage.
Well, that was Michael Cole backtracking. I find these tag ones confusing.
It was like, very confusing, and obviously the announcers were just as confused because nobody really knew. Can you come back in? I just don't like it. The object of a match, it's like the Royal Rumble. The object of a match is to get out. You shouldn't be able to come back in after you get back
out. And it shouldn't be a handicap to achieve the goal too early in the match. You know what I mean?
Well, like, it could be a strategy. I didn't mind that aspect of it because
why would you leave your tag partner though to be in a handicap?
He wasn't intentionally leaving. In fact, you had Edge and Christian forcibly push Jeff.
Oh, okay. You say strategically for the other team.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
That part's
because there would
fine.
Be no incentive to leave unless your partner could join
right.
you.
And that part's fine for the advantage, but then you shouldn't be able to come back in afterwards.
So I remember we've reviewed the 2001 Survivor Series, and the Hardys and Dudleys had a tag match. And in that match, I do remember, I think it was Matt got out of the cage, and they did not let him back in. And that one was really frustrating because I think Matt left on his own. And then could not come back into the match.
That was dumb.
So in this, yes, Jeff was later able to return. But anyway, Jeff is trying to climb back in as Matt's getting double teamed and they keep sending him back to the floor. And at one point, Jimmy Corderas gets into the face of Jeff Hardy and Jeff is yelling at him, I want back in. And Jimmy says no. So what does Jeff do? He shoves Jimmy Corderas into the cage, laying him out. And I ran this by Jimmy this morning, actually, and he recalled this fondly and said, yeah, well, I had the I can't do the Jimmy voice adequate here, but, I had the key gimmick on my wrist. So Jeff grabbed the key off of his wrist, and that is how Jeff was able to open the door and bring a chair into the ring and then grabbed a second chair. Christian actually went to the floor and grabbed the second chair. Matt was busted open. Edge at one point did the mock Matt Hardy yell, pointing out his fingers and stuff that I found mm-hmm. funny. And then he put the key down his pants.
Yes. No one's getting that.
No. Put it on his Val Venus.
Ah, yes.
And Matt ducks a
conch. Maybe Lita would get it for the Hardys.
In a few years, she would. Anyway. Anyway, Matt ducks a concerto and responds with a double clothesline. Hardy tries to climb to the floor, but Christian is across with him, and Jeff throws a ladder at Christian. Christian lands on the floor, so we just are down to Edge and Matt inside of the ring. Edge gets upset at Jeff on the ladder trying to climb in, and Edge gets back suplexed, and then Jeff climbs to the top of the cage, just like gingerly walks to the middle and hits his whisper in the wind to Matt and Edge. I don't know if he connected at all with them. This was quite the visual.
Yeah. And I don't know if he should have connected. I mean, it's a lot of weight to come
down.
Oh,
yeah. This was crazy.
This was insane, though, which is absolutely...
Like, this guy had no hesitancy.
Nope.
Just tightroping to the middle of the cage.
No, not only that, he climbed to the middle of the cage, suspended completely except for his feet, and he takes his shirt off. I mean, not to... Taking your shirt off on the ground is fine, okay, but to take your shirt off on top of a cage with nothing holding on to hold on to, that takes... That's very impressive to me.
It was hot.
No. There. What?
No, you had to take your shirt off. It was too hot up that.
I thought you meant you were getting aroused.
No. I meant the temperature was hot for
what
you.
What I mean is
this robe.
Listen, it sounds so stupid to be impressed at somebody being able to take his shirt off and not lose his balance. But man, to do it on top of a cage without looking, I don't know. I find that impressive.
I was impressed with the sequence he performed.
Yeah,
and just the nonchalant walk he did. He did like a power walk to the middle of the cage.
He doesn't think.
No worry about slipping or anything. Anyway, so he hits this big spot, and then Christian is on the ladder, and Lita runs out. He's on the floor on the ladder. I don't know what he was trying to do here, but Lita low blows him and hits a Hurricane Rana to Christian. This was like the safest Hurricane Rana off a ladder possible.
It wasn't that safe. Like, Lita landed pretty hard. On the ground.
But she really angled herself away from the ladder and getting Christian away from the ladder. That's more what I was looking for. Okay. I guess you are right. Edge tosses the ladder at Jeff's face, climbs up, but then the Hardys follow with ladders. All three are seated on the top of the cage with chairs, and the Hardys hit a concerto to Edge, who takes a bump off the top to the mat, and they climb to the floor, winning the tag titles in 13 minutes and 33 seconds. Second tag title win for the two. Really, really good match here.
Yeah, I mean, following the TLC, which just occurred the month prior, they had a lot to live up to,
and certainly
this match is not one you is not one of the most memorable ones of the series that these teams would have, but it certainly lives up there. They delivered on all the high spots. You had Jeff Hardy do a corkscrew moonsault off the top, and then a number of smaller spots too that were pretty insane, and certainly of the quality of what these guys were delivering at the time.
And as well, on top of this, the Hardys talked about this in this book, that they were supposed to win the tag titles the month prior at SummerSlam. It was in Raleigh, North Carolina, just outside of Cameron. But then the day of the show, they changed it for Edge and Christian to keep the titles and then getting their win in Philadelphia. Yeah. So after this cage match, Way, the next night they debuted on TNN, and the guys arrive after this cage match and are told, "You're doing a ladder match tonight on free TV."
Oh, man.
And that was the match where Edge did it was the first time he did the spot where he speared Jeff hanging from the top. And it's quite the visual.
Just insane.
Yeah. These guys were killing themselves at this point, and they were...
You can always, make the argument that...
you do stupid things when you're trying to get over it.
Yeah,
guys, and it was working.
It made their careers. It made all six of these men's careers. But you can also argue how much time did it take off of their careers in general, and also did they need to do this every single night like they were being called upon to do? If they didn't have a match like this on Unforgiven 2000, would they be in any of a more different place?
Would it tarnish their legacy?
I don't think so.
Great career, but man, that night in September, straight tag match. Stephanie's in her office, and Austin walks in, asks where Hunter is, and she says, "I have a surprise for you. It's his hat that he was wearing the night he was hit by the car, and she's been praying for him." And Austin just laughs this off, says, "Great, I was hit by a car, but you've got my hat." And Stephanie says that Shane knows who hit him with the car, and Austin says he doesn't trust anyone. Hunter then walks into Foley's makeshift area here, brings up how many times that he's beaten him, and jokes about Angle. And tonight he says it's business, he's going to destroy Angle, and Foley said he was considering getting involved in the match tonight, but now he's just going to let them go at it. So that was
that.
Lawler then returns to commentary, and they just unceremoniously kick Michael Cole out of the announce table.
Michael Cole just walks up.
Get out of here.
Passes by the King. Cole extends to shake his hand, and the King just like doesn't even make eye contact. Oh. Pats him in the back, and he just walks out. You could see the heel turn brewing.
Oh, for years. Yeah. This was 11 years in the making. We had a video.
I thought I was dreaming here. I thought I was watching Raw today, and all of a sudden my fantasies had come true. Michael Cole leaving the announce booth for Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler.
No. Nope. We got a video for the next match, building up Eddie Guerrero defending the Intercontinental title against Rikishi, Wei Ting's future main eventer. And this was Eddie at some of his finest here when he was paired with China. And Eddie here had basically turned heel. He was doing everything in his power to keep the title and put the title ahead of China. But China was just oblivious to this. And this featured China revealing she'd be in Playboy, Eddie going to the Playboy mansion.
Classic. Classic.
Some great vignettes at this point. And China telling Eddie, my heart can't take this anymore. I mean, China was just... her porn acting finest in acting.
If Eddie was upset about her being Playboy, good thing he wasn't around to see what she's doing
he
today.
He would have been able to stomach this.
Yeah.
Man, watching his comrades here take their turn with her. And then this leads to Eddie proposing to China, and she says yes and turns a blind eye to Eddie's heelish ways.
Well, marriage does that.
Yeah. China Guerrero. We were so close.
Wow.
Yeah. Latina heat. Anyway, Eddie Guerrero against Rikishi here. Waller mentions it was funny because we had watched this whole prior interplay with Ross and Lawler, and then here Lawler just says, by the way, Jim, I don't want to talk about the Taz match. After he's just like been joking, like he's not cared at all about this match, just to throw it in there, I don't feel like talking about it. So that's why we're not going to address my humbling defeat from half an hour ago. Eddie gets slumped into the corner when the match starts, but gets out of the way of a stink face. And then Eddie uses China as a shield on the floor, shoves her into Rikishi, and Eddie climbs up and hits a cross body, sending him into the steps. Guerrero misses a frog splash in the ring, and then Eddie takes a splash in the corner and messes. Rikishi goes to basically toss him into the air into an ace crusher, but fucked this up, or into a Samoan drop. But, Jim Ross just says, I don't know what he was trying to do there. And Rikishi then went for a bonsai drop, but China breaks the count, and Rikishi is pissed. And he goes after China, shoves her down, then kicks her in the head.
Yeah.
And the bell is called at 6 minutes and 4 seconds. This does not stop Rikishi from attacking this woman. Bonsai drops her, and then says, kiss my ass, China.
Yeah, there's no way they would get
man
away
on
with
woman violence as Philadelphia cheers.
There's no way they would have gotten away with this.
Probably not.
I don't know if this was the intent, but you certainly felt rumblings of Rikishi's heel turn at this point. I mean, how could you read this as anything but?
And afterwards, Eddie goes to we think he's going to check on China, but he runs past her to grab his title first. So Eddie was great here. I really enjoyed this.
You know, this wasn't much of a match, and maybe some people might look back on this and say, "Hey, what a waste of Eddie." But you know what? This was a part of his career that just showed how versatile he was. Because not only is this man great mat wrestler, great high flyer, great technical brawler, this guy could cut a serious promo. He could do comedy too, and he did everything tremendously. So, in my opinion, one of the most versatile, well-rounded performers ever in pro wrestling.
The stuff with China is, to me, what really broke him through as just this really dynamic performer that people got to see.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very important program for him, being paired with China. Coachman is with The Undertaker. He spits on the floor, and he refers to the others in the match as Dem Boys.
Oh.
Dem Boys. So maybe a young Jay and Mark Briscoe were watching this and got some career inspiration.
Probably would have been like, what, 12?
They'd be very young at this point. He said that they're going to be humbled, and this was pretty much 30 seconds for Undertaker to work in as many catchphrases as he could. I'm the big dog, and that's my yard, and I run the yard.
I really don't remember at the time the transition. I don't think I was watching too closely, but like, what was the explanation for him to all of a sudden appear as this biker?
He had an injury, and he came back as a biker.
Just
with Kid Rock.
Started talking like this.
Yeah, he went from a satanic to a biker. You know,
there's
that
no explanation. He wasn't resurrected in any way. It was just,
It was like,
I don't know.
It was like the transition of JBL, who it's like, yes, he was this guy who legit had this financial background at the time and was doing a lot of stuff. But the audience didn't know that. They watched this redneck beer drinker who suddenly showed up with short hair and a suit.
But JBL had always, he released that financial book. He was always on Fox News. It's a relatively easy enough transition. He just changed his shirt.
I felt it was a little drastic at the time, but Undertaker was not exempt from that either. Then they show Kurt Angle legit crying in the locker room about his match, about Austin hitting him. Stephanie's mad at him. So Trish walks in saying that if you need a friend, just let me know. And he instantly gets an idea and leaves. And the backdrop to this is that they were subtly teasing that maybe Kurt Angle is gay. And that would be revealed in this video here. Building up Triple H and Kurt Angle, with Angle kissing Stephanie and Stephanie not fighting him off. And what was also noticeable here, Wei, is that Kurt Angle's voice is non-recognizable in 2000 compared to today.
Really?
He has picked up quite the raspiness to his voice over the years. Oh. This guy sounded like a 15-year-old in 2000.
He looked 15 years younger.
He looked extremely younger.
Yeah.
Anyway, then they did this segment where basically, Hunter says, brings up the fact that, why would you just want to be friends with my hot wife? Maybe you just want to be friends and go shopping with Stephanie. Like going shopping for drapes, you homosexual. To which the crowd...
He didn't say homosexual.
Well, that's what was implied
here,
was that he was gay. And therefore, the crowd could not possibly cheer for a gay man in 2000.
No, you really can't.
This was, wow. Wrestling at its finest in 2000.
Yeah. But stuff like this happens. Still?
I guess.
No, you could, you know, you would call somebody maybe like some type of pansy.
So then in the final angle, Kurt attacks Hunter with a sledgehammer to the ribs and then kisses Stephanie against her will. So he said, I'm not a homosexual. I'm a closet rapist. He just forced himself onto Stephanie here. This is not a...
I think you're exaggerating a little.
Of course I'm exaggerating for effect here, but this is a man forcing himself on a woman.
All right. Yeah. I try to imagine if these characters were real and you, I don't know, John Pollock was in some type of position of power to do something about it. I don't know. It would be odd. I think you would have a lot of time on, taking care of these issues. You'd be very angry about a lot of things that you'd see.
Oh, maybe. We go on to our next match. It's Kurt Angle and Triple H with Mick Foley as the guest referee. And Angle is working on the ribs of Hunter, which are taped stemming from that angle. He gets in the face of Foley, and Angle ends up taking a bump after shoving Foley, and the crowd is chanting for Foley. Lawler asks if Jack Tunney ever officiated a match, and Ross jokes, yeah, that one time in Kitchener. Mm-hmm. And Angle reverses an Irish whip, and Hunter flips over the corner down to the floor. Hunter then goes for a chair shot and goes for the pedigree onto the announce table, but Angle hits a low blow and then suplexes Hunter with a belly-to-belly through the Spanish table here. And Ross says, I don't think Triple H really believes Angle lives an alternate lifestyle. Maybe this is all just Triple H trying to fuck with him. So this was the storyline. I'm not exaggerating this.
Yeah, it was.
Angle misses a running shoulder block into the corner, but recovers, hits a belly-to-belly with Hunter seated on the top, then uses the abdominal stretch, and Hunter tosses him, delivers a bunch of elbow drops. Angle misses his moonsault off the top, and then Hunter hits the knee lift, goes for the pedigree, but can only use one arm because the ribs are bothering him so badly. I thought he sold his ribs fantastic throughout this match. It was really good. And then Stephanie comes down to check on him, and Hunter yells, you have to choose. And Stephanie gets behind Kurt, kicks him low, and Hunter, Super Hunter, now can use both arms, pedigrees him, and pins Kurt at 17 minutes and 27 seconds. And Hunter gets up. The announcers play up if Stephanie regrets her decision, and Hunter yells at Angle and then forces himself onto Stephanie and gets blood on her as he violently kisses her, is the best way I can describe it.
This looked
extremely awkward and weird.
You should be a social worker for the WWE.
Hey, I'm just analyzing what I'm watching, Wei. Was this... I don't know.
I think you're looking too deep into it. Come on, this is nothing unusual in pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Somebody calling
this
another...
This is my property. This woman is mine. I own her. I do what I want with her.
This has been happening in storytelling throughout centuries. No, I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying this is a great storytelling, but I mean, this is hardly anything to be upset about. Come on.
All right. Kurt Angle, by the way, would win the WWF title at the next pay-per-view. So I question the booking of this.
I agree with you.
Kurt would get a pinfall on Hunter a few weeks later on TV in a tag match, I believe it was, where he got help from Benoit to spin off Hunter and Benoit.
Okay.
But to me, this was a match that I think you could have done a lot with, and they chose to put Hunter over strong.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps you can look at this as one of the examples of the Triple H that...
we'd all grow to love.
Yeah, like why Triple H has the reputation that he has. And it's perhaps... programs like these where you have a clear idea of who should be going over, yet the, you know, doing like the gay thing, just burying a guy like Kurt Angle. But hey, Kurt Angle, not even a year into his run in the WWF at this point, and just looking so great in the ring, accomplishing a lot.
Was a great match.
His technical ability was just so good.
Yeah, this was less than a year on the main roster, so yeah. A very, very good match here, and there's a real big singles match for Kurt, probably his biggest singles match to date at that point on a pay-per-view. Shane McMahon comes out. First they show Too Cool at WWF New York dancing around, and then Shane comes out for this big segment where he says that he can reveal who the culprit was. He was hoping Austin would talk to him privately, but now he's got to do this on worldwide pay-per-view, and says it's not someone you would expect, but it's someone with a history of vehicular attacks. And they pulled out a video from 1999 where Steve Blackman backed up his car hitting Ken Shamrock. So what does this mean? It meant Steve Blackman in his spandex shorts and Gold's Gym shirt that he was wearing in this 99 video must have run over Steve Austin. He must have.
Crowd just boos.
What?
Crowd just boos.
Steve
what?
Blackman?
What a disappointment. Steve Blackman.
Wow.
The guy who was in the Hardcore Invitational.
Steve Blackman comes out as Shane is on the floor. But as Blackman comes out, then Austin's music hits. The crowd goes insane. Austin stuns Blackman, and Shane is shoving Blackman to the floor and wants to celebrate with Austin, grabs a beer cooler, has a few beers. But then Austin stuns Shane. Ross confirms Austin does not believe it was Steve Blackman.
What I liked was that Shane took a sip of beer and then just kept the beer in his mouth until he was stunned, and then he did the water fountain.
Flair for the dramatics, says Shane McMahon. Hits him with three stunners, and Ross says this is the biggest reaction I have ever heard in my 25 years of broadcasting.
What a moment. Oh, what a moment in WWF history.
So there you go. It was a big Austin segment that they had advertised, and the mystery of who ran him over continues.
Yes. They advertised that he would arrive.
Yes. They never said that they were going to finalize who it would be, but in the next few weeks they would. And that's something, solve it on TV. I'm fine with that. You were moving to a new network, and that was their big hook.
Do you think that they knew at this point who they were going to name as the guy who ran over?
I don't know. Maybe.
I can't see that.
I don't know. It seemed like it was someone that, who can we give this to? And they went with Rikishi.
Yeah.
Then we got the video pumping up the main event, which featured an animation of a target on The Rock's head, and pretty much everyone hitting everyone's finish on everyone. Undertaker telling Rock he's going to go medieval on his ass and tries to run him over with a motorcycle. And then Michael Cole is with The Rock, who does a comedy promo about Kane lighting himself on fire.
We should name the participants of the match.
Oh, right. We've got The Rock, The Undertaker, Kane, and Chris Benoit. And he talks about Kane lighting himself on fire, Benoit licking a Wolverine's testicle, and The Undertaker getting aroused by riding a motorcycle.
We look back at The Rock in the Attitude Era promo so fondly, but man, some of this stuff in terms of content was almost as bad as what we get from John Cena today, just with way better delivery, obviously. But the come on, the testicle We were going nuts for all this. Everybody loved this.
You know what tied in 2000 with 2012 in this promo?
What's that?
He made a nipple reference.
All right.
Yep. And then The Undertaker comes out and to his Kid Rock theme.
Mm-hmm.
And our match begins. Seven referees were in this ring at the start of the match. Seven.
Wow.
They were not screwing around here. Rock and Benoit fought into the crowd as Kane and Taker remained in the ring. And then Benoit is on the floor as Taker and Rock double-team Kane, clothesline him to the floor, and then they fight. Benoit comes back with a chair shot to The Undertaker and pins him. They tease the finish here.
Benoit wins the title.
Benoit is the champion.
The internet explodes.
It goes crazy.
Twitter goes crazy.
But immediately, Mick Foley comes out and restarts the match. I don't know what this was, because they didn't even play this up for its dramatic purpose. This was just like almost... It was almost like it was a mistake, it felt like. It was just, they didn't play it up at all. It was just like, let's just continue, let's continue.
Maybe they wanted to test the reaction. I don't know. This was a long time before they would actually do it, though.
Yeah, this would be, they would wait for another 3.5 years. Yeah. But anyway, the match continues, and they show the replay of Undertaker clearly having his foot into the ropes during the pinfall. And Benoit thinks he's won the title when Mick Foley restarts it. And he turns around on the ramp with the title, and Taker, Kane, and The Rock are all staring at him as Jim Ross complains, Chris Benoit has the death sentence.
And
they fight at the entrance. That was our line of the Benoit line of the pay-per-view. Good sequence here with Rock and Benoit when they were in the ring together, including three Germans by Benoit, with the last one being a bridge for a two count, hit the diving headbutt. Then The Rock got the crossface on Benoit, but Kane chokeslams him. Kane chokeslams Taker and then gets broken up by Benoit. Benoit cuts off Rock from hitting the people's elbow to Kane, and this was the most furious the crowd was, that they did not get to see the people's elbow.
Mm-hmm.
Taker hit the last ride, Kane made the save, then Benoit hit chair shots to Taker and Kane and ran in to apply the crossface to Rock, but Taker breaks that hold. Ross was really putting over Benoit big here, I think, knowing he wasn't winning, but keeping him strong nonetheless. Kane chokeslam Benoit. Then Kane pulls Taker out of the ring, and they continue fighting, and Rock hits a rock bottom to Benoit. Kane stops Undertaker from making the save, which logically makes no sense, why you would stop someone from saving the finish. Like, why would you do that?
It would not
You're
make sense.
You're fucked. Yeah. And Rock gets the win, pinning Benoit. And fast-paced main event. And that was that.
Yeah.
Way wasn't as big a fan.
I really wasn't. I didn't think the match ever became that great, because I think about all the, perhaps all the great multi-man matches that these guys would have, including The Undertaker and The Rock and Chris Benoit. And there's just so much better than what this was. This just wasn't a very memorable match. Didn't really have the drama or flow of one of the better multi-man matches that I've seen on pay-per-view. So I just thought a very average Raw caliber match.
What was your match of the show?
Match of the show, I gotta go with the cage match, definitely. Because to see Edge and Christian and the Hardys at this point was definitely special. They had a lot, they were just giving it everything. Like, not giving a fuck. Jumping off of cages, everything. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the Sean Waltman and Chris Jericho match. And the Hunter Angle match was very good, too. So three very solid matches.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Hunter and Angle. I wasn't crazy about the finish, but I really enjoyed that match. And overall, a good show. So let's go in here.
What do you rate it?
I will give it I'll give it a 7 out of 10.
I give it a 6.
Enjoyable show.
6.5.
We go here to our feedback, and Alexander Rios writes, anytime you guys review WWF from 2000, I always get a smile on my face for it being the gold standard of modern age pro wrestling, at least on the WWF side. Everything seemed to go right in that company, though the same can't be said for the competition. But Raw getting 6.0 ratings, SmackDown getting 5.0, and both shows getting booked equally, damn, I missed that. Anyway, on to the Unforgiven show, and for a run-of-the-mill pay-per-view in 2000, today this would be like a Starcade-type supercard. So many great things on this show. Right to Censor, which at the time I loved to hate them, and that whistle was instant heat. Eddie Guerrero versus Rikishi was solid and seemed to be building both guys. This is until Rikishi did it for The Rock and stopped the momentum flat. X-Pac Jericho was a solid undercard match, and while I don't care for Lawler Taz, especially after the wasted booking on Taz since debuting at Madison Square Garden, I popped huge for Raven, who sadly also got misused in the following years. Hunter and Angle, with hair, was awkward because Were they not both heels with Foley as the babyface referee? Was the babyface ref supposed to go over? This was odd to me. Austin, Disturbed theme and all, got the loudest pop of the night. And sure, they were milking time when they gave Shane a million stunners, but he was so over and just ate it up. And finally, the main event. The tease of Benoit winning the title was a nice throwback to the earlier tease at Fully Loaded. It was clear that The Rock was the number one guy at this point, and was not going to lose the title. Undertaker and Kane feud again. How many times would this be rehashed over the years? Very good show. I'm curious, any versions you watch have the old SmackDown Your Vote campaign, since 2000 was an election year too. 9 stunners out of 10.
I didn't see any of those segments on the version that I watched. Although, John, you did see a bonus footage.
Yes, after
on the home
they
video.
Had a 10-minute post-show wrap-up with Jonathan Coachman. And
on the home video.
Yeah, we had interviews backstage with The Rock, Kurt Angle, and the Hardys, a bunch of fans who were very excited about this show. So it's up on Daily Motion.
Do they still do these?
No.
Post-fight reactions?
No, not really.
Okay. Paul Ellett from the UK says, it always makes me a little depressed to watch a show from 2000 and compare it to today. The Dudleys, for instance, they could move effortlessly between opening a pay-per-view to a tag match main event on Raw involving The Rock and not really lose any momentum. The other thing I noticed was how in the backstage segments the camera seemed to hover slightly. Compared to today, where everything is framed perfectly with fades and background lighting, this hovering camera sold the 10-year-old me that these were over-the-top characters who just happened to get away with things that a normal person couldn't. The other thing that I liked was how even if they weren't in a single group or a tag team, there were unspoken links between characters. In real life, you simply don't have friends and enemies. You have people you're closer to than others. Here you had TNA with Trish, who herself managed Val Venus in that year, offering Kurt advice. It tied everyone together and made everyone seem relevant. I've always thought that this cage match between the Hardys and Edge and Christian gets forgotten about when put up to all the TLC and ladder matches with the Dudleys. It's a huge shame because there's a great story here that ties together all the high spots. I still highly rate the Triple H, Stephanie, Kurt stuff today as some of the best soap opera elements that WWE has ever featured. It would have been nice to stretch it up for one or two more pay-per-views, but at least they didn't go cold on Kurt after this. Rock proved in the main event why he was in top form at this time, with some so-so guys following a few months working with Triple H in the main events. I don't think there was much about that. There was much doubt that Rock would lose the title, but it was good enough. 8 Tony Dances out of 10.
Oh, high praise. Blaine writes, this was actually one of my favorite pay-per-views of this era, and it's one that I always go back and watch. It's hard to believe how many guys were over at this time, whereas today some of the main eventers aren't even over. Raven showing up during the scrap match was a nice surprise, and I don't think they really needed to hype up his debut or anything, since Austin's return was the hook for this show anyway. The Hardcore Battle Royal was the typical comedy match with pizza boxes and mannequin heads being used as weapons, but it was pretty entertaining at a mid-card level. I really liked the cage match. It looked like Hardy wasn't supposed to escape so early, as it made little sense in terms of strategy, but there were a lot of innovative spots in that one. Angle and Hunter was definitely match of the night. I didn't care for the ending, but I thought it really solidified Angle as a top guy, as he really dominated most of the match. I wasn't so much a fan of a four-way as the main event, but it did kind of serve its purpose, which was to position Rock as the underdog. I had been looking forward to Austin's return for a while, and can't say I was disappointed. This could have done without the segment with him and Kurt Angle, since Angle was in the co-main event, and this just made him look goofy. I would argue a lot of stuff made him look goofy at this point, but at least they didn't give him too much too soon. As far as who the assailant was,
Kevin from Ireland says, other people are going to cover the very good matches on the show, but for me at this time, it was all about Austin's return. It completely made me forget his ill-timed cameo at Backlash that year when he was hardly mobile and wildly out of shape. Here he was looking great and was in full-on BMF mode. I have to credit Shane O'Mac and the segment with him, Austin and Steve Blackman. Shane's facial expressions were priceless, and he is possibly the bestseller of the stunner. Taker used to undersell and Rock oversold, but Shane O'Mac got it spot on. It also kickstarted an awesome Stone Cold Triple H feud that resulted in that great 3 stages of hell match at No Way Out in 2001.
We go on over to Ferus from Malaysia. Unforgiven will forever be one of the shows that is special for me because it was the first then WWF pay-per-view that I bought. During this time, I was circumcised and had to be in my bed recuperating for one whole month. Luckily, my family permitted me to buy a VCD set of a WWF pay-per-view, and I chose this event that had the Biker Taker on the cover of the VCD. Interesting to see that a UFC event was bundled into this VCD pack too, featuring Dan Severn. The show itself was solid from top to bottom, a typical show during the Attitude Era. The opening eight-man tag was a hot opener, and I still can't believe that JBL actually danced during the SmackDown prior to this show. Taz Lawler served its purpose, and Raven debuted in a proper way in front of a hot Philly crowd. The Hardcore Battle Royal was a clusterfuck, but not as bad as WrestleMania 2000. Jericho X-Pac was a fun little match between the two. The tag match inside the cage was a classic match between the Hardys and ENC. Eddie and Rikishi was more of an angle, and interesting to note that China helped two guys, Jericho and Eddie, to find solid footing in the WWF. Triple H and Angle match was solid, despite the ridiculous storyline, and actually elevated Angle to be a main eventer. Pop for Austin was gigantic and could only be rivaled by Foley winning the title or Triple H coming back at MSG. Four-way was decent and showed why this period was fondly remembered. 8 out of 10 for the circumcised Farouz.
Perhaps the first, perhaps the only circumcision story of a wrestling fan's memories.
Yeah, and clearly necessary information he needed to include there, so thanks.
All right, Bretton Vancouver. I can honestly say I don't remember this card at all, except for the crappy feud that was Lawler and Taz. I wanted to chime in because I never watch anything live, and I can't give feedback, so I just want to say, great show. I've been listening for a while, and I'm diligently going through every archive review or way show. The archive is great. Love the shows and keep on reviewing. By the way, I'll take this opportunity to mention that a listener of ours, Gonzo, has taken up the challenge to chronologically organize every single one of our reviews into the event order. So if you if you're listening to this one, Unforgiven 2000, you can perhaps follow it up with the next review that we've done of this era. So thank you, Gonzo, for going ahead with that. I'll be posting that up in the episode archives under Review Away. So just look for that if you so choose to follow all of our podcasts chronologically, which I always thought was going to be a great idea, just a lot of work to do. So we thank Gonzo for going ahead and doing that.
All right. Yeah, fantastic. We go now on over to Corey Ferreira. This is one of the more hit-and-miss shows the WWF gave us in 2000. The Hunter Angle feud was great around this time, but I feel the match could have been a lot better for two guys who were in the top three work rate range in 2000. I'm not saying the match is bad or anything, I'm just saying it could have been a bit better. The Jericho X-Pac match is solid, and despite what fans think of Waltman from mid-2000 until he leaves WWF in 02, he still could give a solid mid-card match, but you got a feel for Jericho. 2 months ago, he was facing Hunter in a great last-man-standing match, and now he's back facing Edge. No, facing X-Pac. Edge and Christian the Hardys give another great tag match, which is underlooked because of the classic ladder and TLC matches, but this one is quite solid. WWF title match was just a match. I don't see the need to have Kane and Undertaker here, or maybe I'm just low about the Kane and Undertaker team we get from Taker's return earlier in the year until the end of 01, and he gives this show a... No, he just says, overall, a show that has some good matches, but with a lot of bad mid-card stuff.
We go to Jim, who says, hey fellas, not a bad pay-per-view, and a great Philly crowd. What a reception for Raven, making his first post-Johnny Polo WWF appearance. Who could have guessed that Raven would go on to become a 26-time WWF Hardcore Champion? What a legacy. Speaking of Hardcore Championships, is there an official reason why matches practically never go into the crowd anymore? It might be a cheap pop, but that doesn't make it bad. On the very next episode of Raw, after I wrote this, the WWE Champion is involved in an altercation in the crowd. I jinxed it. That cage match was absolutely nuts. I don't really have a problem with matches like these. What I do have a problem with is wrestlers who do that more than a few times in their career, let alone more than a few times in 1 year like these guys did. During the Eddie Rikishi pre-match video package, someone started to say, "You used me, you used me," and I was sure it was Eddie, but it was China, and I began to dry heave like our fearless leader. The Undertaker looked older in 2000 than he did in WrestleMania 28. Unlike Taker, the American Badass gimmick has not aged well at all. The real main event was Kurt Angle's exclusive post-match interview for WWF Home Video. The fourth I is I.
I.
The fan interviews were rather telling on that home video. The WWF had a stranglehold on that 18 to 34 middle-class demographic. It's hard to fathom that there'll ever be a big wrestling boom like that again. Overall, I'd give the show a 3 out of 4.
We go on over to Hawkeye Jefferson from the Cosmos.
Okay.
This is an overall all right show. While the APN Dudleys versus RTC was a bland opener and King Taz was something that was better suited for a Raw, the crowd seemed to be into the plunder-filled clubberfest of a hardcore title match that was popular in this era, even though the concept was on its last legs. Jericho, X-Pac, and Hardy ZNC continued showcasing what WWF was doing well at that time, a technically solid undercard and a well-rounded tag division. After a dud that was the epic clash of ass versus mullet, this pay-per-view ended strongly, with Angle versus Hunter finally wrestling one-on-one after months of a long build and the great interaction before Angle took a bad bump at SummerSlam the month prior in the fatal four-way for the WWF title. I will give this pay-per-view bonus points because, unless I'm mistaken, this event had a build that involved Mick Foley and Triple H buddying up in the opening segment of a Raw, months after trying to kill one another for the WWF title to bully Kurt Angle. The build also had Kane interjecting himself in the WWF title picture by smacking The Undertaker in the head with a "say it with me, kids" unprotected chair shot before telling The Rock, "your ass is mine." So bizarrely out of character for Kane at the time that I can't help but be amused. I give the show 7 unprotected chair shots out of 10. And that is our feedback way to Unforgiven 2000 from September the 24th of 2000. Stephanie McMahon's birthday, as was noted on this show. She turned 24.
What?
She was 24.
That's incredible.
Yep,
so she's what, 36 now?
Yep, 36. So that is going to wrap us up, everyone. Thanks a lot for your feedback and for checking out the show today as we went back in time 12 years ago. And next week, Wei, what are we going to review?
A lot of you guys have asked us what we thought about this. We are going to review the CM Punk DVD.
Best in the world.
Yeah.
3-disc set. Wei Ting and I are going to watch the entire documentary.
All 3 discs.
Give our thoughts. And we are going to have a special guest next week, Wei. We can confirm it. Joining us next week on Review Away will be one of the men featured in this documentary. Colt Cabana will be with us on Review Away. So it should be a fun time next week. And we will be taking your feedback to the Punk DVD and maybe some questions for Colt if you want to post them as well in that thread. So that's all coming up next week on Review Away. In the meantime, you can catch The Law from this past weekend featuring Jim Cornette. We've also got the full half-hour interview with Cornette up on iTunes. If you subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling, a nearly two-hour edition of Review of Raw with myself and Wei chatting about tons of stuff, including the New Japan pay-per-view, which is getting rave reviews from people.
And the CM Punk, the subject of our DVD review next week.
Oh, yes, yes. Him versus the Fan. Lots of stuff coming out on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be back Friday with Review and Impact with myself, Wei, and Nate Milton. Lots of stuff coming up in the next little while. It's a busy time in the world of professional wrestling, Wei.
It really is. And, you know, this gives you guys a week. The DVD comes out today, I believe.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. And so watch it this weekend. Leave your thoughts and then listen to what we have to say.
Yes. And a note here for those in Canada that want to catch the UFC 153 press conference from Rio de Janeiro will be airing live on Fight Network at 1 p.m. Eastern Time with myself, Sarah Davis, John Ramdean, and Robin Black hosting the whole thing. We will be on the desk chatting about whatever goes down at the press conference in preparation for Anderson Silva and Stephen Bonner Saturday night in Rio de Janeiro.
This is a rarity. This is a press conference from another continent.
Oh, yes.
Apparently this costs them a lot of money to do.
Well, good for them. That's we will take advantage of their satellite fees. All right, so give us a follow at Law Radio, at Wei0937, and go check out liveaudiowrestling.com and music. I think that, you know, the backdrop to Hunter and Kurt Angle's program was pretty straightforward, I think. So I think, and I don't mean that as a pun, straightforward, but I feel...
What? A pun for what?
The fact that...
Oh.
Yes. So here we go, because Kurt Angle and his character was a heterosexual man.
Ah. Not bad.
Literally just thought of it.
Good. Good stuff.